I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about Batman Begins, the 2005 film directed by Christopher Nolan, screenplay by Christopher Nolan and David S. Goyer. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Trisha Aran.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Gallegos.
Hi.
So this is going to be the first in a series of three podcasts that we're doing on the Dark Knight trilogy, and I'm very excited about it. Also, this month, our patrons are voting amongst the other Nolan filmography for what our patron-exclusive episode will be. So, patrons, keep an eye out for that. Very excited. It's a Nolan-filled month, because Once Upon a Time, Tenet might come out this month.
Right.
Maybe in an alternate universe it has. Batman Begins is really, really interesting. Revisiting it was a fascinating experience for me, because the context is so different. You have to talk about context when talking about Batman Begins, because watching it now, and especially, you know, after The Dark Knight has come out, The Dark Knight overshadows Batman Begins in basically every single possible way, I feel. And so it's weird going back to Batman Begins, and it feels kind of goofy, and there are these weird things in it, and which is impressive also to realize that the Batman film that came before this one was hyper goofy.
Uh-huh.
And so it's weird that this one was a step down from that goofiness. But then I did kind of shift my brain back to remembering being in the theater in 2005, going to see a new Batman film from the director that did that one Memento movie, and seeing something that I had never seen before, which is the super serious, trying to be hyper real picture of Batman with this incredibly talented cast and just this whole other approach. And I remembered how crazy that was and how special that was. So it was very fascinating trying to watch this film, looking at it from both of those lenses. So I'm curious for you guys what it was like revisiting it this time around.
Yeah, I liked Batman Forever when I was, 15 or whatever. And then Batman and Robin, I was just like, what is happening? Even
I
at that age, I was like, why?
I was down.
When you were a child, I was a young man. So, I was like, but I was a big fan of Memento, and I enjoyed Insomnia, and I had seen Christian Bale in Equilibrium and American Psycho. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, I kind of get where these two things coming together what that's going to result in, So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And there are definitely some goofy things, the tank chase and just some of the more Batman-y kinds of things that are happening. And when you are used to The Dark Knight, you go back and watch this and you're like, okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, especially in 2005, I was just very happy for there to be a Batman movie that felt like what I wanted a Batman movie to be.
Yeah, I mean, same for me. I think it was a real thrill to see it in theaters, and because I wasn't overly attached to the Batman franchise. I hadn't even seen all of the Tim Burton Batmans at that point. I think I'd seen like Batman and Robin. It was like my main first like Batman memory, like George Clooney.
Joel Schumacher, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't have like a deep connection to the franchise. And this film was really exciting because it had that awesome Hans Zimmer, James Newton Howard score that was really like cool. And I think The Last Samurai had come out recently or maybe a couple of years before, which also had like an epic Hans Zimmer score, and it kind of reminded me of that. And this even had like katana sword fighting. I think there was like a moment with like we're gonna do like Asian sword fighting in all the movies. So it hit a lot of my sweet spots, and it made me a Batman fan, because I kind of, for me, it sold me on this is a really interesting character with a really interesting origin story. And the themes that the movie was very overtly grappling with were interesting.
Yeah.
So I found it to be like way beyond what I had expected from like a Batman movie. And I was excited about it too, because I had seen Memento, and it was like, oh, wow, they're letting this guy make a superhero movie. What does that mean?
Right.
So yeah, I walked out of the theater kind of thrilled, because it ends with that like cut to black, cut to the title with the Hans Zimmer music. And you're just like, oh yeah, I'm pumped. That's my memory of it.
It's interesting to think back to a world where there weren't a lot of superhero movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, right.
Especially the early 2000s, where it was all like garbage.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Like they did make a couple, but they were more in the style of the 90s. Batmans, like 80s and 90s, those Batman movies that were inherently sort of goofy. And the interesting thing that I think is really smart about, I mean, there's so much that's smart about Nolan's approach to the way that he like rebooted this franchise and like approached the character. But Batman as a character, going back, you know, obviously to the comic books, is not super in the way that basically all of the other DC comic book heroes are. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not Superman. He's not Wonder Woman. Like, he has a lot of money. And then in, that's his main power. And then in this movie, he gets a lot of skills, right? But he is not a super character. And so starting, and he's not Spider-Man, which Spider-Man had already come out. The, like...
One and two, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those films were out, but again, that's a totally different kind of a superhero. Deciding that Batman should be grounded because obviously of all the superheroes that there are, Batman should be grounded was, of course, it seems really fundamental now, but at the time was really, really cool. Also that we'd never seen the character's origin story in a movie before. And then there aren't superheroes in the world of Batman, like in the world of the Nolan trilogy. There aren't other superheroes. So like when he's explaining to Alfred that he's going to become a symbol, they're like, a symbol. Interesting.
Right.
What does that mean? Right. And he's like, and so you're not going to tell anyone your true identity. Interesting. Okay, I see. Okay. They're just kind of like explaining what a superhero is to you, which of course now plays like sort of goofy because we're so steeped and oversaturated in superheroes. Everything about it is just really, really smart because it's cutting through the noise. There wasn't a ton of noise, but it's cutting through the legacy, the noise of the legacy, which is like all of these like super comic booky, goofy things.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that like I thought that every supporting character was surely from the comic books. And like, so I was so confused when I first went and saw this movie because I was like, Rachel Dawes, I don't remember her. Who's she? She's probably from the comic books. I should read the comic books. And even like Ra's al Ghul, he is from the comic books, but he's not, you know, one of the like huge penguin-y,
like Joker-y. Yeah.
Right. Those kinds of Batman villains. So it's like really, really, it's just great.
Yeah. Well, the thing that also excited me about this movie was that my Batman growing up was the animated series.
Right. Yeah.
Which with Kevin Conroy as Batman and Mark Hamill as the Joker. And so that's what I saw a lot of. So for me, seeing Ra's al Ghul and Scarecrow and seeing Gary Oldman deliver kind of a similar Jim Gordon as the show, that all made me happy because I was like, oh, this is more my childhood. Even though, again, like I did watch the earlier Batman movies, the Burtons and the Schumachers, but it felt like that was the Batman that I spent more time with as a kid. Weirdly, the Batman Arkham games that came out over the past decade brought back the creator of that show and Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill and like a lot of the cast and stuff, and actually sort of turned that show into this next level series of video game stories. So that was really cool too. But I think that that's what felt good to me about Batman Begins was that it wasn't, here are the same four villains you know.
Exactly.
Especially when you're sort of doing a reboot. It's not just here are the villains you've seen every single time. We're going to do something different. And for me, that different was something familiar to me, but more of a niche way than to the public, maybe, you know. So I felt like it was like, ooh, cool. It's my thing now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think Batman was maybe the, you know, superhero I was most familiar with because for some reason as a kid, I think we had Batman the movie, the 1966 one with Adam West, like on VHS. And I loved it. I would watch it over and over again. And when I see clips of it, I have visceral memories because the villain's plan is he dehydrates people into like powdered dust that kind of looked like candy that made me want to eat it as a kid. And then the finale is this like really tense scene where they're like rehydrating like the UN members or whatever. Anyway, it's
like the way the Batman figures out who's involved is he's like the shark was pulling my leg, the Joker must be involved. Like it's like this the weirdest.
It's a
just
trip.
Camp I love at its most beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. We should have started with that one.
Honestly.
And then I didn't really watch the animated series at all, but Captain Christian, one of his first video essays that he did was on Batman Evolving the Legend and talking about that animated series, which I really didn't know that much about. And watching that video made me really appreciate it. So I recommend checking that out.
Also, real quick, the score of the animated series, the theme, makes its way into Hans Zimmer's score, at least in Dark Knight Rises. I don't know if it's all three movies or not, but I just remember listening to Dark Knight Rises soundtrack at one point and being like, oh my gosh. So sorry, Michael, you're saying.
That's a cool nod.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I loved the Tim Burton films, and I even managed to love, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger, George Clooney ones. Like, that was fun for me as a child. So I actually had some like resistance initially the first time I watched this film because it was so different than every other Batman. And obviously that is the point. But it was weird for me. How old was I? So 2005. How old am I?
11.
Am I 11? Is that all? No, I'm 19.
To me, you were, yeah.
That was like after high school, beginning of college.
Okay, right. Yeah. So I was old enough to, appreciate it. But also I had these fond memories of like Batman, fun. He's going to put on the suit. He's going to like fight
nipples.
Crime and it's going to be,
right.
And instead the first 20 minutes is like, it's a scene from The Prestige also randomly where Christian Bale is in this weird foreign prison for some reason.
Yes.
And you don't know what's going on or why he's there. And then there's a flashback to explain the like, it's so Christopher Nolan and all that.
Yep.
And it was very disorienting for me. And it's not until the midpoint that like he becomes Batman.
Right.
And that was odd.
It's an origin story.
This is exactly Michael's issue with Casino Royale, the other gritty reboot from the mid-aughts, which was, it's not stupid like the Bond or Batman that I'm used to. How dare they make a real movie?
I'm really with you, though, Michael, because I didn't like this movie the first time I saw it. And part of the reason why is it didn't meet my expectations, but also it's this really layered and slowly paced thing in the first act. It's boring. Like, I don't know. It's not actually boring. There's a lot of ninjas and a lot of glaciers. It's really beautiful.
A lot of glaciers.
And, you know, it isn't this Batman in Gotham urban story. And they actually did a good job of, like, in the first, I don't know, 20 minutes, investing me in the Bruce and Rachel, like, plot line, the romantic interest. And then they just stop that for 45 minutes while he goes and fights ninjas. It is disorienting. It's got several layers of time shifts to it. It's basically like a almost 1 hour long training sequence. Very, very elaborate training sequence. And in a way that I think ultimately holds the movie together thematically, because without that whole big chunk, the movie's not about anything. And Bruce's journey is not about anything. But when you're in it, and the movie starts, you have no idea what the movie is going to be. It doesn't do a great job of taking, you know, we've talked about this before, like in a first act, you almost want to like take the audience to all the places you'll kind of eventually go, or like hint at where you're eventually going, kind of. The movie doesn't really do that at all. It just sort of strands you in Nepal for a while and or wherever he is and kind of leaves you going, where is this heading?
And it's interesting because I do think, like you were saying, it that is what makes this movie unique and what motivates this whole new Nolan trilogy.
Exactly.
Is that it takes the time to ground itself. But I was thinking while watching it, does this movie work if I don't know that it's a Batman movie? And I feel like it kind of is trying to do both at the same time, where it's trying
if you're just watching a character like wander through.
Where you like it kind of works as that, but also I think it relies on you knowing at some point there's going to be Batman happening for you to like go along with it. And so I think that's just kind of where there's this interesting like almost disconnect, or just a meta murkiness kind of what it thinks the audience is bringing or expecting with it.
That's exactly what you can do if your film is called Batman Begins. Use that to your advantage. Like, we know Batman is coming. Let's do something special here where it's like the first half of the film, there's no Batman. It's about this person named Bruce Wayne,
right,
who's gone on this crazy journey to kind of like face his fears and transform himself. I was so down with the like Memento structure at the beginning.
You get some audience patience for free, which it just is what it is. Like, I'm not critiquing it. I'm just saying there's a screenwriting thing in there where like, and there are many ways to get patience or like to get stuff for free from your audience. You know, one of those is like really leaning into genre convention, like, or if you're writing in a genre, for example. So you can kind of like gain ground with your audience in a number of ways by using like cinematic shorthand. But there's a meta thing that's happening here that you're talking about, Michael, where you get some stuff for free from your audience that you don't get if this movie isn't Batman.
Yeah, I have a friend who strongly believes, I don't know if he feels this way now, like that the MCU exists, which he's a fan of, but he always used to say that a movie should exist in and of itself. Like a movie should be able to stand alone. So for him, he got really annoyed at the end of Red Dragon when someone comes in and says, oh, there's an FBI agent here. I'll tell her, you know, you're not interested or whatever. And he turns and says, what is her name? And it's like credits, you know. And then Batman Begins does the exact same thing with the like he left his calling card. It's a Joker credits. And his argument was always like, that doesn't mean anything in this movie.
Right.
It means something in the meta. And I don't think there's a right answer to that question, but I think that different people are going to have different expectations of if you are going into a Batman movie or an MCU movie or whatever.
Star Wars.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Like you're expected to have a certain knowledge going in, but should those movies strive to stand alone or not, you know? And it's different when it's a direct sequel, but it's not when it's a reboot. Like Batman mm-hmm. Begins is the first movie in its own thing. So, you know, hey, there's a calling card doesn't mean anything to somebody just watching Batman Begins. Just like the first hour may not be interesting to people who don't know that Batman is coming. I think that you absolutely are always making any art with reference to a society that people are aware of and in conversation mm-hmm. with and that kind of thing. But I do think it's an interesting argument that movies shouldn't rely too heavily on that.
I agree that it is just kind of an interesting space to be working in. And I think overall the film does balance that in an interesting way. It did kind of leave me with this weird feeling at the end of it where I was like, I really enjoyed this and this is cool, but I don't feel like I got what I like came in for. Like I don't feel like I got the Batman movie that I wanted when I sat down, but it did brilliantly set up The Dark Knight, which we will talk about in the next episode, where you get everything and more that you want.
Well, I feel like in some ways, like the title Batman Begins, like the fact that it says like begins at the end, like when it cuts to black, that's where the title comes on. It's like, right. It's kind of like now it's going to begin. Cause like we basically spent a whole movie just getting him to be.
It's the first act of the trilogy. Yeah.
It's like getting him to be fully Batman. And like now Gordon is like going to be his main contact. And now there's, yeah, Joker calling card. And like now the actual Batman you all know and love can maybe start. But we took a whole movie, 2.5 hours, whatnot, to get just to here. So if you were hoping to get beyond the begins, I had the same feeling where it's kind of like, wow, this really was just all set up almost, this whole movie.
Yeah, your friend's argument is interesting, like in the abstract, but of course, doesn't mean anything on the ground because right. there is no universe in which no one has seen a movie, right? Like, so
right. Every movie is in conversation with like what movies are these days,
film
right.
history, mm-hmm. and yeah. like everything. And that's what I was saying about getting stuff for free from the audience and like leaning into genre convention or like using cinematic shorthand or visual shorthand for something, even, you know, apart from like a piece of IP, all of that stuff is a good thing ultimately. Like, understanding that your audience is smart. They've seen a movie before. So you mm-hmm. can like skip around with some stuff. You can utilize the different tools of filmmaking because your audience has a working knowledge of what movies are. It's ultimately a good thing. I think it just goes back to when you are dealing with something like this that is part of an existing or like utilizing a piece of intellectual property that has a huge presence in the culture, then it becomes just how much do you use it? And that's why I was talking about the disorientation here. It's really interesting because they're trading on, hey, this is a Batman movie. You love Batman. You're going to like this movie. Go with us through this first very, very meandering first huge chunk of it because we're going to give you what you want. So they're utilizing that. But at the same time, they're throwing curveballs at us with characters we're not familiar with. And the League of Shadows, which is also like Ra's al Ghul is from the comics. The League of Shadows is not. Mm-hmm. And everyone is like, the who? The what now? Their whole plan's to destroy Gotham? That's a weird mission for a ninja organization.
So wait, so that whole like, you know, like ancient organization that brought down Rome, none of that's in any of the comics?
Not as far as I could tell in my research. If I am wrong, I looked into it because I was like, they seem very concerned with destroying civilizations, especially Gotham. Very much Gotham all the time.
Yeah, the way he talks about Gotham in this film, it almost sounds like it's like the New York City of this world, or
of
like,
of course it is.
It's like mm-hmm. the, yeah, it's like the city of its time, and so it would be the Rome equivalent, which was interesting because I know they shoot so much of it in Chicago, the new series. I'm like, no, it's not New York, it's Chicago.
Yeah,
yeah.
Until it's Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's really interesting. Like, how much of that do you use? Right. You have existing IP. Your audience is relatively familiar with it. How much of it do you use?
Yeah. There are very few people in the world who can say that Meryl Streep played them in a movie. I, unfortunately, am not one of those people, though I'm holding out hope. She could do it, you know she could. Susan Orlean, however, is one of those people. If that name sounds familiar, it's because besides being a staff writer at The New Yorker, Susan Orlean is the author of 8 books, one of them being The Orchid Thief, which the movie adaptation, screenplay by Charlie Kaufman, was based on. Susan Orlean has created a class called Creative Nonfiction, Write Truth with Style. And you can check it out today on Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community where millions come together to take the next step in their creative journey. With thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people on topics including illustration, design, photography, freelancing, writing, and more. If you're as interested as I am in learning about the creative process of other writers, then I think you will really enjoy Susan's class. And it's just one of the thousands of classes available on Skillshare. And if you use our link, skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay, you get 2 free months of premium membership. Once again, that's skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay. Or click on the link in the show notes. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. I was watching the behind the scenes making of stuff on the Blu-ray, and they do talk about Ra's al Ghul being from the comics, and they don't talk about exactly what his plan was, but that in the comics he is a much bigger picture thinker than someone like the Joker or right, yeah, like that kind of a
he's
thing.
He's basically Thanos. That's his whole plan, is destroy huge chunks of the population to save the world from ecological disaster.
Right.
So yeah, so that's interesting. And then another thing that I thought was interesting is that there was they used a clip from an interview with Paul Levitz, who was the president and publisher of DC Comics. Maybe still is, I don't know. But he was talking about origin stories, and I realized that the idea of an origin story has kind of become, you know, just kind of for granted. Or someone says, oh yeah, it's a new movie, it's an origin story for this character, and now we have a ton of examples of that.
Right.
But this was, I feel like this did kind of set the bar for that. And he was saying, you know, the magic of origin story is that it provides us with the most fundamental moment of connection with the character. Mm. And I think the strongest origin stories obviously do that really well. And I think this film, as you were saying early on, I think, Alex, that this movie has a theme, and it really wants you to know that its theme is fear.
Fear. It's about fear.
Every other word... And yeah. The first act is fear. But it does do, obviously, I guess, that work of providing a more clear motivation for why someone might become Batman. And I think that is kind of the crowning achievement of it, because that's definitely absent, I think, in all the previous Batman movies.
Absolutely.
Well, I think looking at The Dark Knight, it feels like actually I don't really think about Christian Bale very much in that movie. Like, it's all about the Joker and the almost like the twists and turns of the story and the maniacal plot, and I don't really think about the actual character of Bruce Wayne that much. But Batman Begins, it's all about Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And it really is a deep dive, like, character study of this kind of iconic figure. So it's fun to revisit Batman Begins and remember that it was like, oh, at one point this series like was really about Christian Bale and really about this character, because it doesn't feel so much that way, especially in The Dark Knight. And that was interesting to revisit, because I think when I think about The Dark Knight trilogy, I actually don't really think about Christian Bale that much, weirdly, even though he's Batman.
All right.
like I think about everything else about the trilogy, about Christopher Nolan's direction, about the style, the look, the villains. And Batman Begins is because maybe it's the least watched out of them, it's good to remember that like there is a part of this trilogy that is all about Bruce Wayne. And that's really the center of the story.
Well, the movie takes a lot of care, both when they're on screen, which isn't for very long, but just throughout the film, to really talk about Bruce's family and their legacy and who they are and what they believe in, like what their value system is. I really love the scene. It's doing exposition as hard as it can, but I really, really love the scene where they're on their way to the opera and they're riding in the public transit system, which is like really smart character design to make the Waynes, who are incredibly wealthy, to make Thomas Wayne not at all care about his money. He's a doctor. Bruce is like, Dad, do you work in that building in like, you know, Wayne Tower or whatever, Wayne Enterprises? And he's like, no, I work at the hospital, son.
I help people. I am the best billionaire you've ever met.
And he's like, better men run that company. Better men? Well, men who are more interested in it. It's like, but it is smart character design, because the biggest problem with Bruce has always been that he has money, and not just in this sort of like more aware sort of class moment that we're in right now, but it's always been a problem with the character, because Batman is there to help the people. And how can he help the people when he has all of the money? And so it's a really smart reworking of Thomas Wayne as a character, just approach to Thomas Wayne as a character. And then to spend a decent amount of time throughout the rest of the movie reminding us that his legacy is about helping the people of Gotham. Like, Fox tells him, yeah, he almost bankrupted the company trying to like bail Gotham out of the Depression. And then Ra's al Ghul is like, your dad was a big problem for us. Your family was a big problem for us when we were using the Depression to.
Yeah. This time we tried a new tactic. Economics.
Yeah. It's like, how do you do that?
It's silly. Everything about the League of Shadows is silly, but everything about the design of the Waynes helps explain the character of Bruce. And it's very, very smart, because not only does it make him relatable, it makes him Batman.
Well, even if it's silly and doesn't make sense, like the movie is very thematically unified. Like,
exactly.
Everything comes back to this idea of, I mean, there's the core, like, you know, facing your fear, you know, kind of becoming your fear to overcome it with Bruce Wayne. But then in the bigger kind of socioeconomic Thanos kind of discussion,
right,
everything ties back to that as well. Even
exactly
the Wayne family legacy is part of that bigger Thanos style story about, should we just burn it all down or try to save it? And Batman comes down on the side of, let's try to save it, as opposed to driving everybody crazy with hallucinogenic flower dust.
Yes. Now,
listen, David S. Goyer has had some bad trips, I think. There is so many bad trips in this movie.
I was watching the scene where he has to fight the ninjas while he's super high, and I was like, this is the worst.
I want to continue what you were saying, Alex, but also, if you had a microwave emitter that would vaporize all of the water in the city, would it not vaporize all the water in human bodies?
It absolutely would. Yes. Like,
it's very nice of them to selectively somehow engineer.
Only in pipes.
Right. That is what's weird about it, is that once it gets going, I think my favorite part of this film is there's the handoff between the first part of Bruce Wayne wandering aimlessly and learning how to do stuff, and then he's back, and now we're seeing him become Batman, and that's fun when it's like,
it's,
I'm
really
fun, discover this cave and what's this crazy car, I think this is going to be the new Batmobile, everybody. Like, that whole section is really, really fun. And then once he's there, it kind of goes goofy again, or in this more almost like classic Batman goofy way. And I think that is what's just the unevenness of the film kind of expresses itself there, and even visually, you know, the Narrows, which never shows up ever again in the trilogy, and it's this like weird CGI / miniature maybe model that sits in the middle of this. It's just weird how it transitions to that goofy mode. But my favorite part is during that handoff, because it's, you're kind of getting the best of both worlds. And I feel like that is the zone that then the Dark Knight exists in completely.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned like the chemical thing where it's like you have this trilogy where they said no magic, because even if Batman is a character without superpowers, Batman villains tend to be, you know, depending on the comic, depending on the show, whatever, they did a fairly good job with the six villains across this trilogy saying that they also don't have superpowers. There is no magic in this world. Mm-hmm. But then you do get, here's a chemical that makes you see your worst fears, and here's a guy who's huge and can break your back, and here's, you know, someone whose face got burned off in just the right way, you know. So I mean I think that like they definitely still, I would say like it's not as bad as the Iron Man trilogy, which just gets less and less, makes less and less of an attempt as it goes on to try to sell that everything is science. And it's just like by Iron Man 3, you're like, it's just magic.
Yeah.
Right.
But Iron Man also exists in the Avengers universe. So whatever.
Which is full of magic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Magic entirely. Yeah.
But that is the interesting thing about Batman, is that if you're not, like, you're either living in Poison Ivy can talk to Oliver Plant's world, or you're living in the bad guy's just a ninja who has like a weird beard and is really upset about things. Like,
exactly.
Also, why did all the ninjas have, like, why did they pack their house with explosives? Was a thought I was having as the whole thing was anyway.
One thing I do really like about the design of Ducard, quote unquote, Liam Neeson and Ken Watanabe's Ra's al Ghul, is that because I was a fan of the animated series, I knew what Ra's al Ghul looked like. So I knew to expect that goatee and stuff. And they were able to sell it just by saying, like, these are how these people look. So you are able to sell that idea of, like, this is actually Ra's al Ghul. This is just Ducard, who's kind of his henchman. And then twist. So, like, even for, like, Batman fans, it's like, oh, okay, we'll buy that he's Ra's al Ghul for now, until it's like, no, the bigger actor in this movie is actually the real villain.
That's what I was going to say.
Right.
It's like, Liam Neeson doesn't just casually leave a movie right at minute 40.
Oh, he does.
Liam Neeson's, I mean.
We talked about this. In, like, every movie in the mid-aughts, Liam Neeson was the, like, the mentor who then dies. And
if he dies, then that's sure. fine. But
right.
when
right.
he lives and
well,
you
but
just...
also, oh, no. Ra's al Ghul can come back to life. As that's per true. The animated series, so
that's true.
Which is why it was really cool. They put him in Dark Knight Rises as a, is he actually back? No, he's just a figment. Anyway, we'll get into that later.
I do remember when I first saw the film, like, I was genuinely surprised. Like, I did not expect Liam Neeson to come back. I thought it was just like, yeah, you know, Bruce Wayne's showing he's a better person than these people by saving his mentor.
Right.
And I really wasn't hooked into the fact that this was going to be ultimately a Ra's al Ghul. Like villain film. I really was on board with, like, oh, it's Scarecrow and he's doing weird drug stuff, I guess. That was a genuinely good twist for me when I first saw it in theaters. And I was confused because there was like, here's like a decoy Asian man and like the old lady who's going to bring you to him.
Oh, never, the actual, like, reveal.
Yeah, never turn, go away now to the rest of the party. I'm here, Liam Neeson. Like, that was just kind of a funny theatric.
Yeah, definitely a lot of like. Yeah. We are definitely tricking you right now.
Theatricality and deception are useful tools, you guys.
True. Took that a bit literally, didn't you, Mr. Wayne?
Yeah, so does he.
Says Liam Neeson's. Or Qui-Gon. I like to call him both while watching these movies.
Why would anyone want to call him Qui-Gon? Why would
Qui-Gon's awesome.
Of all the things Liam Neeson has done, though, that you could be reminded of.
I like Qui-Gon.
Yeah,
I like
Qui-Gon.
Qui-Gon's
a badass Jedi.
But Qui-Gon reminds me of the movie that Qui-Gon's in.
One thing I really like about that confrontation when Liam Neeson's Ra's al Ghul eventually, you know, reveals himself at that party is I really like the setting of the room is completely full of people, so they can't just start punching each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen it before in movies, but it's really effective in that scene where there's this sense of politeness and decorum, and it kind of allows, like, there's nothing worse than a monologuing villain when the hero definitely could punch him in the face.
Right.
Did you know what I'm saying?
Or leave.
Right.
Yeah.
Or just right. leave. Yeah, exactly. Escape very quickly and easily. So I really like that. And I like the way that they eventually empty Wayne Manor which is Bruce's drunken, like, insult tirade, quote unquote drunken insulting tirade against all of the guests. I actually think one of this movie's, one of the things that this movie does super well is show us both the persona of Bruce Wayne and the Batman version of Bruce Wayne. And for that reason, Christian Bale is perfect.
Yeah.
Because
American Psycho, he was giving me such American Psycho vibes during some of those Bruce Wayne impersonation monologues.
When you see like the young version of him when he comes back for Chill's trial or like hearing or whatever, and he's supposedly back from Princeton, but he got kicked out. But he's got that like Ivy League schoolboy haircut.
Right.
And he's wearing his like Dockers and his sweater. I buy it. Like he has that polish. He carries himself with the air of wealth.
The Christian Bale guano eating grin.
Wow.
Wow.
You're welcome, Brian. The world.
Yikes.
But he is some of my favorite scenes are the ones where he's playing Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
He's really, really great at those scenes.
Yeah.
And there's no better moment for it than that, you know, when he like tosses all of his guests out of his birthday party. He has to be believable, and he really is. I really like all of that.
And there are stakes because of the family legacy.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
I think every movie in the trilogy has Christian Bale being Dick Bruce Wayne in order to achieve something that, you know, Batman needs like a room cleared or he needs like, I remember there's the scene where he shows up with the two women out of the car, you know, and then Dark Knight, as soon as the helicopter lands, I'm like, it's going to be three. Yep, there it is.
yep.
Oh, they're just swimming in the fountain. It's fine. Also, speaking of Christian Bale, The Machinist was 6 months before.
Right. It's wild.
It's like, nuts.
I feel like
his
like,
poor body.
Yeah. And he looks great in this movie. Like, he doesn't look like super weathered yet, but I feel like by The Dark Knight Rises, he'd done like five more extreme body transformations.
So, right.
Like, he still kind of looks like baby faced and like fresh in Batman Begins. But by Dark Knight Rises, like, Christian Bale, like, take care of yourself, please.
Well, and it's one of the wonderful things about him as an actor is just the complete dedication, you know, to and every single role that he takes, whether it's this or Newsies, he's there for it, man.
Yeah. It's true.
Something that this film also does that's interesting and that is kind of a superhero film problem is like how many villains can you stick in a movie?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I feel like this one just barely navigates it, and The Dark Knight has more time to play with, so I think does it fine. But there is a little bit of like, so we're gonna do Scarecrow, but we're also Ra's al Ghul, but
Falcone?
Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, sure.
Like,
yeah.
It was like a cute mob boss that's there and like
he's adorable. So,
like a button-nosed mob boss.
I know. Tom Wilkinson is like the cutest mob boss.
Just like grab his cheek and pinch it.
You can always fear, but you don't understand. Oh, Tom.
What the hell are you?
But I feel like where it kind of falls apart and ultimately doesn't matter, but when you finally see Scarecrow and he's on the horse. He has the mask and it's like the glowing eyes, and it just feels like a lot of work was done to get to like that shot. So it's like, look, we did Scarecrow.
I guess he took a police horse maybe, but wasn't he already sprayed with the stuff to be crazy? So he's
right.
Like,
well, and like sometimes when they're really afraid, they run and they cower, but sometimes they become like zombies and like
there was a literal like zombie slowly. Scenes where they were like, whoa, like all grabbing somebody.
It's Cillian Murphy. What are you gonna do?
And he's great. He's great as Scarecrow. It was just interesting watching that whole thing happen of like, oh, Scarecrow's here, and then like taser and goodbye at the end.
Right.
I was actually surprised how little Scarecrow was in this movie. Like I was waiting for more of him when I rewatched it, and I was like, oh, he's actually not in the movie a ton. And I think that's how they kind of balance it. But I do appreciate that Cillian Murphy is the only villain who's in all three movies. He has like a cameo in the next two movies.
Right. I do love that.
But yeah, he actually tested for Bruce because, you know, speaking of Cillian Murphy and zombies, Nolan had seen 28 Days Later and was like, oh, I like this guy. And then he showed up and tested for Bruce. And he was like, he gave such a good screen test, but Christian Bale was kind of our first choice. So I gave him Scarecrow. And then it's sort of like, oh, it makes sense that they're like, let's bring him back for the next two movies.
This episode of Beyond the Screenplay is sponsored by Mubi, the curated streaming service that premieres a new film every day. We recently premiered a new video using Pirates of the Caribbean to identify the elements of the adventure genre. While working on the video, we looked back at film history to find some films that inspired not only the adventure genre, but science fiction and horror as well. There are three examples that I want to recommend. For a fun early take on adventure, you can check out the 1939 version of The Man in the Iron Mask. It has some pretty creative visual effects I found equally fascinating and amusing. For some classic expressionist horror, there's the 1922 vampire silent film Nosferatu. And for science fiction, there is, of course, Fritz Lang's 1927 masterpiece Metropolis, one of the most iconic films ever made. If you want to check these films out to do some genre research, all three of them are available on Mubi. Each film on Mubi is hand-picked, there's no algorithm, and it's an amazingly eclectic selection of films from all over the world and from every time period, from old classics to new releases. So if ever you wanted to step out of your particular bubble of film knowledge, Mubi is the perfect place to get started. And you can do so today by heading to mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay to get 30 days for free. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting that question that you just asked, Michael. How many villains can you stick in a movie? I think that unfortunately one of the burdens of the Batman franchise is having so many great villains to choose from. Like, Batman has so many great villains to choose from. And also, because they are, as we just talked about, not magical for the most part, like, Batman fights crime. So they're criminals. They're usually not, like, it's not universe-ending stakes, right? They're here on the streets of Gotham. And, like, if you look at back at, like, the animated series and, like, some of the original versions of the character, the plan always has something to do with, like, money or power, or it's just crime, not in, like, this grand scheme kind of way, typically, even if there is a grand scheme. And so I think that, unfortunately, you have all these great villains. You have so many of them. Their plans are often so similar to each other because they're all just doing crime, which is why you have the existence of something like in many of the, I don't know, I used to watch, I didn't watch the Batman animated series that you're talking about, Brian, but I did watch all of the Justice League cartoons that were on in like the late 90s that are awesome, by the way. And you have all the villains teaming up all the time. Like that's kind of what they end up doing, is because you have so many great villains. They're very theatrical and fun to watch and fun for actors to play and fun to put in your movie or in your show. And so you want
the best part of Batman, the 1966 one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you just want to stick them all in there. And I get that impulse. But then unfortunately, from a story point of view, you then have to tie their plans all together somehow.
Right.
And
right.
And if we don't see them all working together from the beginning, then those have to be reveals. And then you're stuck with three or four of those reveals where it's
right.
Like, actually, Falcone is in the pocket of... So Joe Chill is the original villain. He's in the pocket of Falcone.
Right.
Falcone is then with the Scarecrow. The Scarecrow is then with Ra's al Ghul. But
not
the original Ra's al Ghul. It's a different Ra's al Ghul. There you go, everybody. It's tied together. and it does get exhausting. I think what's great about the Dark Knight, which we're going to talk about, is we know who the big bad is from the jump.
Right. Right.
This is the big bad. And there turns out to be like Two-Face. Is there another one in The Dark Knight?
Mm-mm.
I don't think there is. So and then they do manage to get Two-Face in there, but it's not a reveal because it's a great turning point for that character. But there's one big bad.
Right.
I think that actually is good about The Dark Knight Rises, too. They do a lot of that work with Bane, but then they also do the reveals where it's not. We'll get to that.
Yeah, yeah. Dark Knight Rises is interesting because there's one and two half villains. There's the villain who then ends up not being, and then there's the not who ends up being. We'll get into that. But and like Dark Knight also has Eric Roberts' character. But like there's a difference between superhero villain and like bad guy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like why I don't think of Falcone as like a villain in Batman Begins the way that I think of the other two. But the interesting thing is that the one rule that the studio put on Nolan was every movie has to have, you know, for toy purposes, Every movie has to have two villains, which of course translates to two costumed villains, two toys, you know, a new vehicle and a new suit. So you, you know, conveniently have Batman being like, I need to turn my head. I need to, you know, dogs bit me and like all that kind of stuff.
He does need to turn his head.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think it's beautifully done, but I think that is part of why you end up having to put multiple villains in your movie is because there is an expectation of like, yeah, this is a dark, gritty reboot trilogy, but this is also a superhero, toys, also merchandise, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And I think that's also, you know, there are those weird out of step quip, goofy joke moments that feel like literally it was like a note page from the studio just inserted, where the cop is like, on, they're chasing the Batmobile and he's like, what does it look like? Jerome, never mind. Like,
and like, yeah, like, all three of the films like have those moments where it's like you got to have like a bystander like see a thing go by and like say like, I got to get me one of those.
Yeah.
Right. Nice coat.
Yeah.
Like, what? That's the,
I love that nice coat line because it's right after he says it. That's when the homeless guy he gave his coat to, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Immediately afterwards, he just goes vertically up into the air and there's no indication of like what mechanism is allowing him to just rise vertically.
Where does he get these wonderful toys? And the Dark Knight sometimes rises. It's also...
The last thing I was going to say about Scarecrow's, the reason I think he also works so well in this is that he's used as for the Rachel subplot primarily. Like he's kind of her antagonist and the force that she's fighting the whole time. It kind of avoids that, you know, the double costumed person that you're going to be facing at some point feel.
And I do think that once again, this movie does stick to its theme. Like his whole thing with like making people afraid with his psychotropic drugs like is very on theme, so it's impressive. Even if it doesn't all make sense all the time, it's impressive their dedication to this is all going to be of a piece.
Well, and you get the sense too, and part of this is just Cillian Murphy's performance. He really is wonderful in this. But you get the sense too that Scarecrow, and this is why I think we like bringing him back, he's kind of lovable because he isn't the big bad, and because he doesn't have the like kind of, he's part of the big plan, but his interest in like human psychology makes him more dimensional. It gives him a little bit more interest as a character where he's working for this mob boss and helping get his guys transferred into Arkham. And he does ultimately, you know, dump the drugs into the water supply. But you get the feeling it's almost this like academic curiosity on his part. Like, isn't what fear does to people really fascinating?
Well, he brings up like Jungian archetypes at some point. Yeah. Like, he's clearly like a very smart guy who's just kind of in a sick way enjoying like studying, like screwing
up
people.
He's like a trickster, basically. Where he's like messing with all the things, but doesn't necessarily have
morals,
a specific malice that he's pursuing.
He's more of a Loki character, so we like him a little bit more.
Right, he's more Loki. Brian wasn't going for it, so
my brain went there and was like, "That's low even for me." And then you went there. One last thing I want to mention is one thing I love about this movie is that before filming started, Christopher Nolan had the whole crew sit down and watch Blade Runner.
Yes.
As like an aesthetic inspiration to the movie. And you even have Rutger Hauer in the movie, which is interesting. But I love that as a concept to say, you know, a lot of people, when they make a movie in a franchise, their inspiration is the other movies in the franchise. Mm-hmm. And it just becomes this like cyclical kind of thing. Just like Spider-Man Homecoming was, what if we made a Spider-Man movie that's actually a John Hughes 80s like high school comedy? You know, this was sort of, what if we made a sort of Blade Runner-esque Batman movie? And I love that as an inspiration. And then he also drew from Richard Donner's Superman in the sense of like, let's spend some real time with the cast. Like, let's cast like real actors, you know, Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, Gary Oldman, you know, like real heavy hitters, and then have them play real characters who are dealing with real situations and that kind of thing. And I think that, like, because Richard Donner Superman is one of those comic movies from pre golden age of comic book movies that's like, oh no, but that actually holds up, other than, you know, he flies around the world and it goes backwards, but other than that,
I was
but you do have more, just spending more time with the characters as real people. And then I just also love taking inspiration from, like, the Frank Miller comics and the more adult comic series, rather than trying to make this family friendly kind of, you know, I'll get drive through Batman and Robin type thing. Because people always talk about, like, oh, it's the origin of this character, like, it's the original character. And it's like, when it's Batman, it's been decades and decades of everything. People will find plenty of comics where he kills and plenty of comics where he's not, like, gritty and that kind of thing. That it's not about, like, necessarily what came first. It's a, it's about finding the thing that feels the most sort of most relevant to, I think, the movie that you are trying to make. And I think if you're trying to make a silly movie, that's fine. You know, you can make Lego Batman, like, there's nothing wrong with that. But I also think it's about, like, kind of finding that tone that you want and then just sticking with that and not trying to veer too far outside of it. I think part of the reason that the corny stuff in this movie feels corny is because the rest of the movie is so focused and dark and sort of serious that, like, when it kind of veers away from that, it feels like a huge veer. Whereas if that kind of thing happened in Thor Ragnarok, it would feel completely normal, or it would feel like, okay, yeah, that's what this movie is.
I was struck watching it again how much they emphasize the fear of, like, the goons that Batman is pursuing, like, in the midpoint of the film when there's that, like, container storage area scene.
Where are you?
It's kind of like, it's the way it's structured is like a thriller slasher movie, you know. It's like we're with the henchmen,
right,
and Batman is like the specter, like, scary thing. And that was, that's an interesting choice to not have us with Batman in some of those scenes, but we're seeing the effect he's having as he creates fear in his enemies. And then the whole movie has kind of like a, has a lot of horror elements in it, you know, from the,
for sure,
some of the, like, you know, the psychotropic hallucination things are pretty horrific. And it just goes to places that, yeah, they're not normal superhero places to go. They're usually more in, like, dark psychological thriller or horror. That's also something that was really interesting and refreshing and cool seeing it back in 2005, was like, wow, that was, like, kind of like a dark M. Night Shyamalan. I mean, that was back when he was still exciting. But, you know, that was like, it was a dark, like, thriller experience as well as a superhero movie, which was also tickled 2005 Alex quite a bit.
Yeah. One thing that I think is really smart about this movie and all of the Batman movies, actually, is that they are wisely scaled. They are about Gotham. There is no, there's no, other than, like, we end up over in that resurrection pit prison thing a decent number of times, too many times, I think. But the movies are always about Gotham. And it's really interesting. The films exist in a place of interesting conversation. Obviously, Gotham functions narratively as a microcosm for society in general, society in urban settings in general. But the movies are always in a really interesting conversation. Just the Batman story is involved in what is the responsibility of the individual to one's immediate social system. And so I think that that's, and the movie grapples with this. Like, we've talked about the theme of fear, but it really grapples with the theme of inaction and justice, right? And so, like, I'm struck by what Rachel said in the, says in the car to Bruce at the beginning. What chance does Gotham have when good people do nothing? And so there's something there in, I feel like that is kind of at the core of Bruce's journey in this. And she names the city. She says the city by name. And they say it so much in the Batman movies. Like, every single Batman movie is like, but what about Gotham? And that is the local, political, social community.
Economic
that these people are living in. And it's really interesting that Batman villains, the really evil ones, are like, I will destroy Gotham, right? or in some way I will tear out the trust of the people of Gotham that they have in their community. That's like what a Batman villain wants to do. It's fascinating. Like this idea that I can make people of Gotham turn on each other. I can make neighbors hate each other. I can make them distrust their elected officials. I can destroy the fabric of this social system. And what is the responsibility of the individual as a part of that social system is what Batman is about. And that is cool. Like, that is a cool question for a superhero movie to be asking, because so often our heroes concern themselves with quote unquote bigger problems or like larger ideological problems. And I'm not saying that Batman isn't about that as well. There are these sort of like, and of course, individual, like, you know, emotional journeys or philosophical journeys. Those are always in there as well, but always framed in the sense of, but what do I do about my neighbors or the poor in my community? What do I do with the wealth that I've inherited? What is the real legacy of coming from a place of privilege as a member of a society? That is why I think that people are really fascinated by the world of Batman. It's so much more relatable in that like social storytelling kind of way.
And it lets it be allegorical. Like it doesn't, we don't, if it was set in New York City, we would have feelings about the real politics of New York City.
But right.
Because it's a fictional city that stands in for any metropolis, maybe one more than others, but it lets us access it and think about it in more abstract terms that let us focus on that morality and the bigger questions rather than being distracted by our own personal politics or whatever might be in the way there.
And I'll just add, it also means that the stakes of each conflict like are real stakes, because you can imagine Gotham falling apart. It's hard to imagine how this franchise will go on if the entire world blows up, you know? So that's always interesting in a superhero movie when it's like the bad thing could actually happen and like Batman could still be a thing, you know? Like that raises the stakes quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's when the Spider-Man movies are at their best too, because that is set in New York. But
right,
but this idea of your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, this idea that this is a person who is a part of your own community and really invested in the place where he lives. Spider-Man's kind of asking that exact question, like, and Peter Parker's always wondering that same thing. What's my responsibility to the people immediately around me?
And maybe that's why these Spider-Man and Batman are the two most rebooted characters.
Maybe.
It seems like they really seem to have some staying power. And last thing I was going to say is that I think the most, you know, talking about the theme of fear, the most fearful part of the movie, I think that the movie does for the audience, is when it introduces surprise Joffrey Baratheon.
Oh yeah,
I think that is.
I thought about that.
I'm like, why are we trying to save this kid? Yeah,
the most horrifying. Right, that's the one mistake Batman makes. Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Batman Begins? Alex, would you like to start us off?
So one thing, I was listening to a podcast just today, Russell Brand's podcast, Under the Skin, and he's talking to this guy who kind of is an expert or kind of trying to carry on the tradition of like indigenous mythological storytelling and like and the kind of Jungian hero's journey archetypes of like initiation in indigenous cultures, where it's like, you know, there's this, you know, there's a kind of a male and a female version of it, of like a lot of indigenous cultures, you go off by yourself and kind of go into like this kind of extreme survival situation to kind of find yourself and face your fears and then come back to the tribe kind of like now as an adult, now with new wisdom from that like journey. And there's something that is deeply like resonant about that and really true about that. And I was struck by how much Batman Begins leans on that kind of archetypal journey. I mean, Bruce Wayne literally goes out into the world with nothing, almost starves, like ends up in a prison, and then kind of builds himself back up out of that through his training with Ra's al Ghul, whatever, Liam Neeson. There's something that is very resonant about that journey, and part of why I really enjoy the first half of this movie. Like, I'm kind of okay with it not being a Batman movie for a while, because I really buy that transformation of Bruce Wayne because they show us the whole thing. So I really appreciate the way they very consciously lean into these deep archetypal things about transformation, about the human experience, that have been with us for thousands of years. And I think it's really cool. The movie, because it doesn't take place in Gotham for a lot of the first half, kind of, it doesn't feel like a superhero movie. It feels like this more mythic thing out in the glaciers, out in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Brian?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we talked about this plenty, but this sort of that slow first act where we do have a lot of time spent with Bruce out kind of meandering, even if it's slow, I do appreciate when a movie takes the time to sell me on its concept, whether it's Jurassic Park or The Exorcist or The Shining, or like any like mm-hmm. horror or like comic book movie. Anytime it's sort of this high concept, there's something non-normal happening here. I appreciate when that movie takes time to get me to earn that thing. And I think in the case of Batman Begins, it's specifically the protagonist's motivations that have to be earned, which is, mm-hmm. okay, yeah. this is a gritty crime drama where a guy dresses up like a bat. It's not a fun, silly popcorn movie where a guy dresses up like a bat. It's this gritty crime, like mobster, you know, samurai, whatever it's trying to be. And I think that I love that Nolan insisted on spending a lot of time with Bruce Wayne, such that when he becomes Batman, and when I say becomes Batman, he chooses to become Batman, unlike the magical superheroes who get bitten by a spider or like end up becoming mm-hmm. a superhero whether they want to or not. Mm-hmm. Batman says, no, I am going to make this choice to dress like a bat and say I'm Batman at people, you know, and do a weird voice, you know.
I also do that. Hey.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you just sell this concept of like, oh, I have to become something more than a man. That's how you become an idea or a legend.
Yeah.
Compassion is what separates us from them. That's why I don't kill. That's why I have this rule, you know, all that kind of stuff. And whether or not this is the best example of it, you know, I'm not making that argument. I'm just saying that I really do appreciate.
Yeah.
It's why we do like the origin story, is because we get from normal person, normal as Bruce Wayne can be, you know, normal-ish person to this other thing. Whereas sequels are always, okay, this person's already a superhero, so now what do we do? And there are lots of good answers to that question, lots of bad answers to that question. But I do appreciate anytime a movie takes this amount of time to really make me believe why a character would choose to do something like this.
And it's really, I mean, going off of both your point and Alex's point, it's choosing to do those things leans on what, like, a superhero story is like supposed to be, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's utilizing this kind of story and myth that we have to its fullest potential.
Yes.
In a way that's cool and kind of got lost before it. And maybe like for a while afterwards, it's gotten murkier. But I feel like when those superhero stories are made clear, they are the modern myths with all the archetypes and getting at these big moral ideas and epic, fun, but affecting ways. And Batman Begins is very good at doing that, for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trisha?
I have a lot of, I was going to say complaints, but that's not the word that I mean. I have a lot of thoughts. I have a lot of thoughts about the character design of Rachel Dawes, since she is a completely original character for this trilogy. And she is a really important part of this trilogy. I think that she's not utilized as well as she could be, but the actual design of her character is really, really smart. So I really love that she comes from, like, her mother's a domestic servant in the Wayne household. So she and Bruce know each other from childhood. That's super important to this mm-hmm. character. She has to be able to break through Bruce Wayne's facade mm-hmm. in a way that people that know him as an adult simply can't do. And so it is really effective shortcut to get like straight to the heart of who Bruce Wayne is and allow her to speak straight to the heart of who he is. Mm-hmm. I also really love, there's a lot of things I love about her. She's smart is another one of them. She's really motivated. She comes from, you know, her mother's a domestic servant, and yet she puts herself through law school and like becomes the DA, you know, the ADA. There's a lot of really cool stuff about her as a character. But what I really like is that she is also fighting crime in Gotham. And
right.
she fundamentally disagrees with everything about the way Bruce is doing it. I think both of those things make her a really cool foil for him. And the scene where, again, it's the one that I was talking about when she asks, what chance does Gotham have when good people do nothing? That scene is really compelling because they're tossing back and forth these like ideological approaches to when you see there's something wrong with your city, what do you do about it? And she's like, you're doing it the wrong way. And she at the end says that his dad would be proud of him. I don't think she believes that. I think that, again, they embedded her with all this cool stuff and didn't follow it all the way to its logical conclusions or its logical implications. I also think all of this makes her not a great love interest for Bruce, but a really, really good foil for him because she is there to provide a counterpoint to this rich thematic argument. And it allows her, as you were saying, Michael, to have her own subplot where she is doing something that happens to bring her into the crosshairs of one of the villains. But it's because she's fighting crime in Gotham in her own way. It's not a surprise that she would run into one of the villains. Does she end up being a damsel in distress? Yes. But the motivation for, oh my god, I can't with all of it, but the way that she lands there is properly motivated in her character. There's a lot of really good character work there, actually, just in terms of her design. So there are definitely some lessons to be taken from that, and the biggest one of which is have somebody that's not on the hero side but there to, she kind of is, but mostly there to just really challenge the way he's doing things.
Right. And I think that's such an important part of him becoming who he is like not being allowed to be fundamentalist in this like one like ideology that he has, but running up against this person that he cares a lot, that makes extremely good points and is also right. And you need to listen to her. And somewhere in that push and pull is where like things are supposed to be. Yeah, exactly. I really like Rachel. I also wish she was in it more and kind of didn't disintegrate a little bit in the second half of the film.
Well, and I feel like she provides the like origin for his no kill rule, basically, in that scene in the car where he throws the gun away. It's very clear
when she
that
slaps
that
him.
Came from
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I think that's a really cool decision. She's the only person who really hits him and gets away with it. But
but I mean, I love that moment. It's just that moment feels very raw and very and very clear without really having dialogue. It's like she sees the gun and then she just smacks him and she's pissed off. And
it's good.
She hits him twice. Yeah. I love that she hits him twice.
Yeah, exactly.
Too. She could have just hit him one time and it would have been like, oh, that was a thing that happened.
Right.
She meant it.
Yeah.
She wanted him to know that she meant it.
I have not communicated what I'm saying enough. Second smack.
I only one time in my life smacked someone in the face because I really disagreed with them and thought they needed to be smacked in the face. And I didn't hit them as hard as I wish I had. But because that impulse.
I'm glad we have our meetings over Zoom.
This is Trisha's lesson.
I'm just saying it's like, I wonder if that was a direction from Nolan or if that was just Katie Holmes going like, he didn't feel it the first time. I got to hit him again.
I mean, it was Christian Bale.
I don't know. I think there's a lot to like about Rachel. We'll tune in for the next episode where I bring up all of the other stuff about Rachel. But there's a lot to like here.
Rachel part two.
My lesson is just kind of a filmmaking lesson of appreciating in a way that sometimes I don't. Christopher Nolan's a commitment to making it a grounded reality. And so much of that was in, we want to go to real locations and film in actual places because you can feel the difference. And sometimes I'm like, well, I feel like that's a little bit of just like, I want to be an auteur and I'm going to make a decision that makes life harder for everyone. But I think this is a clear example of where it makes a huge difference. And I mean, it's in the casting, as you were talking about, Brian, but I think because there's this crystal clear comparison between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight and, you know, the Joel Schumacher and Tim Burton Batman films, kind of marching orders for Batman Begins was, we don't want this to feel like it was shot on the Warner Brothers backlot.
Right.
And all the other Batmans completely feel like that. It doesn't feel like a real world whatsoever.
They built sets. Yeah.
And so I feel like this is just a very stark contrast to that, to show what that commitment to going to these crazy places can do for something, especially when you're trying to reboot and realign and make people think about something differently, that these stylistic choices have a very profound and measurable effect, I feel like, in Batman Begins specifically.
And we will talk about Michael Caine. Like,
Right.
Sorry, we haven't mentioned him yet. We got two more movies.
Got two more movies to go.
Hang in there with us. We'll get to it.
You can take the rose out if you like, Mr. White.
Perfect.
Great. Well, why don't we talk about what we have been watching recently? Trisha, you want to start us off?
Sure. So I decided to watch The Atomic Cafe, which is a 1982 documentary that is actually a compilation of footage from U.S. propaganda films about the atomic bomb. And mostly about why the atomic bomb was not a threat to U.S. citizens. So the propaganda films were made in the 50s, obviously. And then the Atomic Cafe, which is sort of just cut together footage from these propaganda movies, was released in 1982. It has an amazing soundtrack of like pop music about the bomb. Which is wild. Like, I'd never heard any of it before. Lots of really interesting songs that people were writing about nuclear war at the time.
I know all of them from the Fallout games. We're going nuclear. All right, go ahead.
That is kind of how they sound.
That is one.
There you go. But then anyway, I decided to make it a double feature after I finished watching that and watched Blast from the Past, starring Brendan Fraser and Alicia Silverstone from 1999.
You mean Batwoman?
That's a blast from the past now.
Yeah, it is.
It
That's
really kind of is. Yeah.
The thing that I remember most from that movie was when they show his parents like how amazing technology is. They microwave a slice of bread. They're like, they put a slice of bread in their microwave. And nobody microwaves a slice of bread. And Brendan Fraser's mom is like so amazed when she like touches it and it's hot.
His parents are played by Christopher Walken and Sissy Spacek. Right. Wow. This movie is actually a real delight. There's a lot of like the swing moment happening from like the '90s.
Yes.
They're doing swing music and whatever. It's also just a really interesting. You don't have to watch them back to back, but I just thought it was interesting because it's obviously Blast from the Past is drawing on what Americans thought about, you know, nuclear war and what the future was going to be in the 50s. So anyway, sorry, what was it, Bri?
Well, you've got Batwoman and Max Schreck from Batman Returns. So it ties in nicely. It pairs nicely with Batman Begins.
Also, Brendan Fraser's character's name is Adam, and Alicia Silverstone's character's name is Eve.
It's really dark.
That's dark.
Yeah, that's a dark choice there.
Yeah. Ava.
We apologize for everything. I do feel like Trisha just like types into a random word generator when we ask her what movie, and then she makes up what that movie is. She's like,
right. Atomic Cafe.
I watched Verdant Meal, the 1963...
I pull them all from Taylor Swift lyrics, actually.
Okay, Brian, what have you been watching?
I watched the Netflix documentary Disclosure, which my friend Jenny Denton was the key grip on, so shout out to her. But it's the Laverne Cox produced documentary about trans representation in Hollywood over like literally as far back as the first movies that have ever existed. And it's sort of a journey through movies and or film, I should say, over the last 100 years, but featuring interviews from these trans women and men who are mostly actors or writers or producers or directors. And it's sort of showing this, you know, history of trans characters historically having been serial killers or prostitutes or the crazy person, or it's just a guy who has to dress up like a woman and that's hilarious because of course it is, kind of thing. And you know, it's interesting because it's not saying like Mrs. Doubtfire is evil or anything like that. It's just saying like when you look at here's all of the representation there was, or 95% of the representation there was, it's a common thread of, well, of course trans people aren't going to be taken seriously because this is all there is, and sort of consistently and repeatedly. But then the nice thing is it also shows the last 10-ish years of representation in Hollywood and how it is starting to turn. And you do have characters who are just a character in a movie, and their transness isn't important to their character. They just exist. Like, I noticed it in season 3 of Jessica Jones, the receptionist she hires. It's just a trans woman, and that's fine. Like, there is no like, well, and I had to make the choice to do this because did it. It's like, nope, we don't have to mention it. It's just there. These people exist, and they should be loved and represented and in things. And yeah, so it's a really cool watch.
Yeah,
very cool, Alex.
I have been watching season 2 of Homecoming on Amazon Prime. And I loved the first season. It was directed entirely by Sam Esmail, who created Mr. Robot. And it was starts Julia Roberts in season 1. And it's just a really fun kind of Hitchcockian, crazy, twisty ride that's in half hour chunks, which is really enjoyable. And the first season's a complete story, so it didn't really need to come back. But they've created a season 2 starring Janelle Monáe. And I was pretty skeptical because Sam Esmail's not back to direct. So I'm like, is it going to be the same? But they've carried on with this real commitment to this like neo Hitchcock style, which is really enjoyable. Really fun score, really fun cinematography, and just a really classic, like kind of a mystery box story, but done in a more old timey way, if that makes sense, where the reveals don't feel like lost. They feel like a Hitchcock reveal. And it's once again in half hour chunks. So it's just kind of an easy, enjoyable watch. So I'd recommend it. It's really fun.
I've been meaning to check this out. So now I definitely need to do this.
Yeah.
So I've been listening to a podcast, season 5 of Revisionist History by Malcolm Gladwell. And I am a huge Malcolm Gladwell fan. I feel like I've probably talked about it before.
You have.
Okay. Did I talk about his book or the podcast? Doesn't
the
matter.
Book.
Today? Okay.
Yes.
Because the book is great. And I also re-listened to that while doing motion graphics recently. But season 5 of his podcast, Revisionist History, is out. And what I love about his approach to things is I feel like the subtitle for every Malcolm Gladwell thing could basically be, here's why human common sense is usually wrong and why we shouldn't listen to it. And it just provides a good perspective, I think, to have in life. And this season has been interesting because there's been a lot more multi-episode chunks. Where earlier seasons, each one was about a different subject. This season, there's been like 7 or 8 episodes, and it's been about 3 subjects, maybe 4 now. But yeah, I highly recommend it because it's very fun and easy to listen to, but it's very enlightening, and it makes you look at things from a different perspective, which I think is always good. And they kind of are also always low-key about social issues happening right now. And so the episodes this season have touched on like the things we value and how we assign money to things, and is that the best way to value things. There's a very fascinating one about, we say this is what democracy in its idealized form should be doing. Here's this other form of democracy that feels super unfair, but has been shown to actually be more fair and achieve the goal that we say we want democracy to do, but it doesn't feel as free. So like, what does that mean? And then there's a really interesting 4-part series on World War II, kind of, since you were just talking about the bomb, Trisha, it's kind of talking about that same period.
Very interesting.
But why we all know about the atomic bomb, but we don't know much about the development of napalm and how that was employed against the Japanese and how horrific all of that was. And
correct.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, it's this perfect blend for me anyway of very enjoyable, but also very enlightening and kind of unsettling in a way that I find useful. So Revisionist History, season 5.
Awesome.
Nice.
Okay. Well, this has been our first episode of 3 on the Dark Knight trilogy, talking about Batman Begins. Next episode, we will, of course, be talking about The Dark Knight. Patrons, you are currently voting and will probably have finished by the time this comes out on what Nolan patron exclusive episode we're going to do. We're very excited to talk about another non-Batman Christopher Nolan film for you guys. And also just wanted to shout out our editor, Eric.
Yay.
You are amazing. We never talk about you.
Eric, we love you.
Eric Schneider, you're amazing. He makes us sound good or less bad, whatever the case may be.
Thanks, Eric.
Eric, don't edit this part out.
So much smarter than we actually sound. Thank you, Eric.
Awesome. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.